This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go. This is hour three of the program. Thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Sure appreciate it. I'd love to talk to you, and my number is 888-914-9149. You can call now. We do have a couple of lines open. That's not pretty common, so take advantage of it. Call 888-914-9149. Let's go to Jasmine now, listening in. Is it Potowa, New Jersey, or Potowa? I never know how to pronounce it.
It's Totowa.
Totowa, gotcha. Well, welcome.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Well, I've been having this long discussion with my older sister. You know, we were all brought up, we were cradle Catholics. Mm-hmm. We were all brought up, like, you know, going to Mass every Sunday and stuff. And unfortunately, she shifted, and she doesn't think she's Catholic anymore. Okay. She's joined another ministry. And we've been discussing the reasons why. And one of them is the Sabbath. Because, you know, originally, I guess the Sabbath falls on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And why did the Catholic Church, I'm not sure why, I mean, moved it
why
to
do
Sunday.
We worship on Sunday instead of the Sabbath day when the Ten Commandments say the commandment, thou shalt keep holy the Sabbath day? Is that the way she's arguing
right.
The point? Okay.
Yes.
Did she by chance join an organization called Seventh-day Adventism? Does that sound familiar?
Well, of course, yes, I'm familiar with that. Not really. I mean, she's joined something that's like totally non-denominational. I mean, they don't believe in the church anymore. They just believe in Jesus Christ. They don't believe in anything else. They don't believe that the church is a structure.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad. I mean, so, mm-hmm. and then they practice Shabbat on Friday nights. And,
is she involved in a kind of,
is she
kind of involved in a, like a Messianic Jewish community where they practice Jewish customs?
No.
Okay. Well, it sounds funny to me then, because Shabbat is the observance of the beginning of the Sabbath, beginning at sundown on Friday. That's a Jewish custom, not a Christian custom. So that makes me wonder, where is that coming from if there's no connection with Judaism?
I think they're just putting things on their own. They're a small group. It's very complicated, and we have all these arguments. She sends me a lot of different quotations, and she says, you know, the end is near and stuff. And I said, why do you know that? I mean, we don't. Okay. Even Jesus doesn't know when the end of days are. I mean, is the angels? Only God knows. And she persists, and that's what they know. He's coming. I go. So, but in any case, one of the biggest arguments she keeps on pushing it is that why do Catholics and Christians now worship on Sundays and not on Saturdays?
I can help you with that. So there are a couple of reasons. Number one, because Jesus gave the church the authority to bind and loose, to do things as the church saw necessary. And Jesus said in Luke 10:16 to the apostles, the first bishops of the church, he who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. Now, sadly, she has rejected the teaching authority of the church, in which case she's actually rejecting Jesus, as Jesus himself has said. He who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. So that's a problem unto itself. But the church, as Jesus granted it, has the authority to bind and loose. We see that in Matthew chapter 16 when he spoke the words to Simon Peter. We see it again in Matthew 18 where he spoke those words to all of the apostles. We see in Matthew chapter 28 in the Great Commission, beginning in verse 19, where Jesus says to the same apostles, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. So the church has this office, this duty, this role, this mission of teaching what Jesus commanded. Now, all of those things are not precisely given to us in the pages of Scripture, but the church has this authority to do so. So that leads us to the question of what about the Sabbath? Well, the Sabbath was the commandment to honor God on this day was transferred from the seventh day of the week, the Sabbath, to the first day of the week, Sunday. The church had the authority to do this. The church had the authority to say, we're going to obviously honor this commandment. We're going to fulfill this commandment, but we're going to do it in a different on a different day. And two of the distinct reasons for that were, number one, that it was a way to honor the Lord because it was on that day that Jesus rose from the dead. So he was in the tomb on the Sabbath, Saturday. He died on Good Friday, was in the tomb on Saturday. He rose from the dead on Sunday. So by the church transferring the observance of the commandment to Sunday, it was a way to greet the Lord. It was a way to honor him for his resurrection on Sunday. It was also a way to show a distinction from the Jews, because one of the problems in the beginning was this confusion about whether or not if you were to become a Christian, did you have to become a Jew first? If you were a male, some said you had to be circumcised. You want to be Catholic, you want to be a Christian? Great, you got to be circumcised. So St. Peter was given a vision by the Lord in Acts chapter 10 when he saw this big tarp that had on top of it all kinds of animals, including animals that were ritually unclean, like pork, for example, and other animals that were forbidden to the Jews to be eaten. So in his dream, in this vision, as this big tarp comes down and he sees all these animals, he hears the voice of God saying, "Rise up, Peter, kill and eat." And of course, as a Jew, that created some confusion for him. Why would God be telling him to eat these animals that he knew from the Mosaic law were ritually unclean? And so God revealed to him those things, like the kosher food laws and other things like them, they no longer apply now. So five chapters later at the Council of Jerusalem, this revelation was discussed by the apostles and the other followers of Jesus. And they recognized and they came to this conclusion, well, you don't have to be Jewish to be Christian. You don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to keep kosher. You don't have to do all these other things, because this has all now been transformed in Christ. So the church, one of the reasons, practically speaking, that the church observed the commandment on the first day of the week, Sunday, is to show this distinction even more so, that it was not a sect of Judaism. This is a new fulfillment. This is something beyond and above anything that came before it. Now, I'll offer you one final thing, because we could go on and on and on. There's so much one could say, but try this when you have the next conversation with her. Point out to her in Genesis chapter 17 that God says to Abraham, he says, "Between you and me, I will establish my covenant." This is in verse 2. Verse 7, "I will maintain my covenant with you and your descendants after you throughout the ages as an everlasting pact to your God, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you." Verse 9, God also said to Abraham, "On your part, you and your descendants after you must keep my covenant throughout the ages." That's like forever and ever. "This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you that you must keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised." Verse 13, "Thus my covenant shall be in your flesh as an everlasting pact." So he continues in this vein and throughout this passage of saying, this is a commandment, this is an everlasting commandment. You and all of your descendants after you until the end of time, you must do this. Okay. I'm quite confident that the group that your sister has taken up with now, if it considers itself a Christian group, that they don't practice circumcision. And this is one of those odd little details here that you can bring up. You can say, look, this commandment was given by God even before the Ten Commandments were given to Moses. And God says this is an everlasting commandment. You and everybody after you has to follow it. Now, why don't you, referring to her church, why don't you practice circumcision? And for good measure, point out that Jesus nowhere said, okay, guys, from now on, you don't have to practice circumcision. You know who said that? The church. After Jesus had ascended to heaven, it was the church that said, all right, you know, here's a commandment from God, and we're going to observe it, but we're going to observe it in a different way now. And the new way that we're going to observe that is through baptism. Baptism replaces circumcision, and baptism is for all, male and female, not just for males. So there you have an example of the church making this decision to observe this commandment given by God and to do it in a different way. And you can point that out to her, and you could say, see, your group doesn't circumcise. And the reason you don't circumcise is because, whether you realize it or not, you went along with what the church decided in the earliest years, and that was to do the same thing. And this is another parallel that you could bring alongside to show that the church has that authority to transfer the observance of the commandment to worship God on the Lord's Day from the Sabbath to Sunday. So much more that one could say, but I feel like I should stop there. I'll leave it at that. Thank you for the call, Jasmine, and I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go now to Brian in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Good morning, Brian.
Oh. Morning.
Yes.
I've been listening to your show for about 2 years, and I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
And you've taught me a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I was thinking about that book that was brought up in the first hour, and that when she asked for a recommendation.
The one about Bless Me Ultima, that book?
That has no place in a Catholic school as a piece of literature, but would you see it valuable as a tool for teaching Catholic apology?
Well, I mean, I haven't read the book, so I can only go on the basis of the synopsis that was given on Wikipedia, where it gives the plot outline. So the plot of the book suggests to me that it's a way to influence somebody away from traditional Christianity and in favor of witchcraft and casting spells and confronting evil spirits and all that nonsense. So I don't see any value in that, certainly not at the level of a high school or a grammar school, which is where I think this book was being used. It's an interesting question you're asking me. What angle do you see that this book might be worthwhile using in an apologetic setting? Because I didn't make that connection.
Yeah. Well, just from what you read about the summary, you know, that perhaps the book could be used to highlight the glorification of witchcraft, to point out the worldview of our faith and how...
Okay, that seems valid to me. Okay, go ahead, Brian.
But I guess we have a further point. I see sometimes how we as Catholics retreat from the culture. And sometimes it's necessary. You know, if there's something inappropriate on TV, I need to protect my kids. But just to say this is bad and we're not going to read it, I think there can be some harm in that because, you know, a child will eventually go on to maybe college and those books will be out there, the same kind of themes and such, and the teachers will have more credibility, more education, and the kids won't be able to identify the inaccuracies. They won't be able to see the attack.
Fair enough, but remember that there's an old adage floating around. I believe it's true, and that is the agents for the federal government that deal with counterfeiting rings and such, that they learn how to spot counterfeit bills, not by studying counterfeit bills, but by studying the real currency and immersing themselves in and becoming experts at detecting all of the features in actual legitimate currency. That way, when they see something that's bogus, they can spot it quickly because they know what the real thing is. They don't do it the other direction. They don't say, okay, everybody, here's a bunch of bogus bills. Study those. And then then you'll go out there and you'll know them when you find them, because far more readily you're going to be able to spot the bogus bills because you know the details of a legitimate bill. I think that is part of the answer to this question. Especially in context, the call that I received, Brian, had to do with kids in school. Kids in school don't need to be indoctrinated into witchcraft or things like that in order to be prepared to deal with it later. Rather, kids at that age, they need to be prepared to understand, well, what is reality and what does Jesus call me to do and what are the truths about this, so that when they get out there and they start bumping into things that aren't true, they'll immediately recognize them because they'll say, wait a minute, that doesn't fit. That's not what I was taught. That doesn't go with what Jesus had to say. That would be my advice. Another reason for that is because children are very impressionable. Now, it may be for you, maybe an apologetics tool that you could study and not be harmed by it. But for a seventh or eighth grader, I don't think they have the intellectual capacity, nor do they have the prudence or the maturity to be able to deal with that the way you might be able to deal with that. So keep in mind that the context of that earlier conversation had to do with children, not with adults. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I really hadn't thought of it that way. Good point.
Yeah, you know, so we want to protect the kids, but we don't want to overprotect them, which is your point. But we don't want to, at the same time, poison them early on, because eventually they're going to come into contact with that. I think I understand what you're talking about, Brian. Maybe this is another analogy. The way, to use the word poison again, the way somebody builds up a tolerance for, say, bee venom. You know, if you're working with bees and you get stung, well, some people, they have really bad reactions to that. So one way that somebody can really develop a high tolerance is to get stung over and over and over again, and eventually the body just develops that tolerance. So the next time you get a bee sting, it's not a big deal. I think snake bites are similar to that as well, where you can build up a tolerance over time. And if that's what you're thinking about, I don't deny that that's true. But I really don't think that with kids we should be experimenting with them that way, personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I guess maybe the Catholic school would not be the proper venue. The parents are the primary educator. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we can, as we're living our lives, we can point out certain things mm-hmm. as they're learning their faith.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll leave it at this, Brian, but I think you're making a good point. I hope you see the point I'm making. Eventually, the kids are going to grow up and learn about the birds and the bees, okay? But when they're young, we don't need to be furnishing them with material about that, because it's not age appropriate. It's not going to help them. If anything, it will probably hurt them. But eventually, they're going to grow to the point where they're going to know more about that. So anyway, thank you for letting me ruminate on this with you, Brian. I appreciate that. Let's go now to Thomas, who's listening in Oceanside, California. Hello, Thomas.
Hi.
How old are you?
8 years old.
8 years old. Right on. So what's on your mind this morning, Thomas?
Is it a mortal sin to be in the special forces because you have to kill?
No, it's not a mortal sin. Obviously, we don't want to kill anybody if we can avoid it. But it would be like being a police officer. You know how a police officer, let's say that he's, you know, protecting a school. Okay, you've heard about some schools where somebody goes in and starts shooting people, right? It's terrible. But you've heard about that, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's say the policeman is there guarding the school, and some crazy guy shows up with a gun and he starts shooting people. Well, the police officer may have to shoot him to stop him from killing more people. He's not doing anything wrong. The police officer is not committing a sin. He's protecting people. And in the same way, special forces, you know, in the military, they're kind of like the policemen, but they're not protecting people at a school. They're protecting people from bad guys from other countries who might want to harm us. You know, so they're protecting people. And if they have to kill somebody in order to protect our country, that's not a sin. Do you see?
Okay.
Does that make sense
yeah.
to you? Okay. Yeah. Are you thinking about being in the military when you get older?
Yeah.
Cool. It's a very honorable thing. All right. Thomas, we got to go, but thanks for the question. God bless you. I'll be right back.
Compelling insights. Unpredictable conversations. Encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. A little blast from the past, huh? 888-914-9149 is the number. We have about half an hour left, so there's time for you to get in if you call 888-914-9149. Let's start off now in Anderson, California with Tina. Good morning, Tina. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I have a quick question.
Sure.
I'm a new Catholic. I just took my first communion and my confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading the Bible because I had heard something about veiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I found something in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1 through 16 about mm-hmm. women praying while their head is covered.
Right.
And I know it's an old practice. I read a book on it. But I'm wondering how you feel about veiling, because my deacon wasn't too thrilled with it.
Well, you know, what can I say? Veiling for women has fallen out of fashion, fallen out of use in the Catholic Church in the West since about the time of the Second Vatican Council. So it is, it's not familiar to the vast majority of women. And that's why I think the deacon, God bless him, was probably not, he was not enthusiastic about it, because he probably rarely, if ever, has even seen that, depending on how old he is. So what do I think about it? I think it's a beautiful thing. I think it's a custom that I'm sorry to see got lost in the shuffle. I like the biblical justification for it. Also, I think that it's a beautiful expression of femininity. And I'm sorry to see that custom has gone by the way. Just as a little aside, my wife did not grow up wearing veils when she was little, so she doesn't wear a veil. And she and I have talked about it before, and I said, I think it's great. I would encourage it. I'd love it. But it's just not something she wants to do. So she never wears a veil. And my daughters grew up not wearing veils either. So it's not as though I'm like forcing this on anybody. But I prefer it myself. I think it's beautiful. Now, if you're interested, I have an article on my blog that I called Veil Wars. Now, it has nothing to do with, you know, wars or fighting, but just that people take different perspectives. So here's a little snippet of it. I read an interesting discussion at a blog about whether or not the Catholic Church still requires women to cover their heads with a veil or hat at Mass. And it refers to an unnamed canon lawyer in that article whose opinion is that, yes, women are still obliged to wear them, even if virtually none do, and critiques the contrary opinion advanced by certain people, and I name them in here, who hold that it's no longer required. And I say, I think the article goes a long way toward convincing me that it is still something that the church should bring back. So if you're interested in reading that, I can make that available on my Twitter feed if you'd like. It's at Patrick Madrid, excuse me, and you'd be able to read that at your leisure. Give you more
information. Okay, well, I'll read it on the website because I'm not on Twitter. I don't go on social media.
Okay.
Thank you very much. One thing, I do morning prayers, my rosary, and I'll just make this real quick. And I do it every morning at 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I veiled this morning when I prayed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that,
we lost
like,
silly? No. Why would it be silly? If you feel more prayerful when you're wearing a veil, great. If you don't feel the need for that, you don't have to by any means. The church doesn't require it. But if it helps to promote your focus on God and the things of God, sure, that's fine.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I just wanted your take on it. You have a
You're
great
welcome,
day.
You're welcome, Tina. Likewise, thank you. Let's go now to Frank in Los Angeles. Hi, Frank.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well.
I'm glad to hear that. I've been listening to you for a long time, and there's times when I agree with you, there's times when I don't, but I want to get some information. Basically,
sure.
The word church, I know that when Christ was born, and being a Jew, that there was a temple, I believe, and mm-hmm. then somehow or another, I heard you this morning saying that if that the church can change the different rules and regulations and such. Mm-hmm. But where did the word church come from? Because I don't know, they had a church during the time that Christ was born.
Right. Well, Christ established his church. He says that, for example, in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, upon this rock I will build my church. And the Greek word that's used there is ecclesia. And that's where we get, for example, in French or in Spanish, words like église or iglesia. It's just the more modern language version of that Greek word, ecclesia. Now, ecclesia just means an assembly. It means people coming together for a purpose. And so that was the Greek word that was used to describe this, the gathering of Christians who were followers of Jesus. It became known as the church. And so when Jesus said these words in Matthew 16, 18, almost certainly, I mean, it seems that Jesus and the apostles clearly spoke Greek and understood Greek, but they didn't typically speak it on a day-to-day basis. They would have spoken Aramaic. So the underlying phraseology of what Jesus says, we don't have that, but we do have the Greek translation of that, and it uses that word church, or we translate ecclesia as church. So synagogue wasn't a word
that was used?
I'm sorry?
Synagogue. Where did synagogue come in from?
Okay. Well, synagogue is a separate word. It certainly was a word that was in use, and the synagogue was where the Jews would gather for their worship and the study of the Torah. It was separate and different from the temple, but there definitely were synagogues. Jesus taught in the synagogues during his public ministry. But this word ecclesia is distinct from synagogue, and it would be used to differentiate this new religion that Jesus had established. It completed and perfected the synagogue religion, and then became known as the church. And so that term, the point I was trying to make was that the term ecclesia did not have necessarily a religious connotation originally, but it took on a religious connotation because it became applied to this particular group of people. And so they referred to themselves as being members of the church. So that's how the word changed in its meaning over time. But that's where you find it. It's not the only place, but that's where you would find it as an example in the New Testament.
Thank you very much. That clears it up for me.
I'm glad, Frank. Thanks for the phone call. Now to Maria in Pennsylvania. Hi, Maria.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I've got a question. I used an opportunity in my confession with a priest in terms of how to love my enemies. And, mm-hmm. and in the confession, I brought up the fact that I was very upset about the so-called shepherds of the church that are misleading their flock in terms of speaking the truth in terms of abortion, closing down the church during this pandemic. And anyway, I asked him and didn't get an answer because I think I stopped him in his footsteps when he knew that I was referring to him in terms of misleading his flock. But I just have a hard time loving my enemies when it comes to I guess the church, Pope, and also these political figures who promote nothing but evilness in terms of abortion and mm-hmm.
So are you asking my advice on how to cope with that feeling of frustration with the people that you see as your enemies and your frustrations with them, how to deal with that? Is that your question for me?
Yeah, like how do I love someone who I know is doing nothing but promoting evil? I know, you know, in the St. Michael the Archangel prayer where it says, cast into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who prowl about the world seeking their own souls. Mm-hmm. Like, why would I want these evil people to spend eternity in heaven with me? When they've done nothing but promote evilness.
Okay. That's a fair question.
Know, it would be like inviting somebody on a vacation with me that I don't agree with,
I understand. Let me offer you some thoughts. Number one, that part of the St. Michael prayer is directed toward, or it's about, the demons. So it's the fallen angels. We don't wish that God would cast into hell any human being. The reason that we can say that about the devils is because they're already damned, and their damnation is permanent and irrevocable. And that's not the case with our fellow human beings. There's always time, at least in this life, for mercy. So ask your question. I understand the emotional impact of this, because in my life there have been people who have really offended me or harmed me in some way, and I can't get over, or maybe it took a long time to get over, the emotional repugnance that I felt for that person. And I've regarded that person perhaps as an enemy, or that person regards me as an enemy. I'm sure there are people out there now who regard me as an enemy. Thankfully, I don't know who they are, but for whatever reason, they may regard me as an enemy. So be it. But the key here is not liking that person. You don't have to like that bishop or that priest or whoever. You don't have to feel happy thoughts, warm and fuzzy about that person. This kind of love is really better described as charity, supernatural charity. The supernatural virtue of charity does not involve emotions, and it certainly does not involve wanting to hang out with somebody who may have done you wrong. What it means is, fundamentally, that you actively will, desire, and hope for the good of that other person. And you may say, how can I do that if this person has been so wretched and sinful and wicked and all the things that may be as you see them, they may not be as you see them. You may have a distorted view. And what you think this person is doing may not, in God's eyes, be something he is necessarily culpable for. We have to let God sort those things out. So my advice to you, and how do you deal with this, is you say to the Lord, Lord, you know I'm aggrieved by this situation. You know that from where I stand, this really looks like a bad situation, and it makes me angry that this is happening, but this is your church, Lord, and I pray for the salvation of the people involved. I pray, Lord, that you will convert their hearts. And only you know their hearts. I don't know their hearts. But from where I stand, this is what it looks like. So, Lord, I pray for the best for this other person. And that's true charity. And that doesn't require any ounce of you having to like that person. In fact, you may say, I'm going to stay far away from you, but I am going to love you insofar as I'm going to pray that God will bless you and bring you to heaven. And look at it this way, Sharon. I'll leave you with this. Unless you are an absolutely perfect person, unless you yourself have never committed a sin ever, then you're really in the same company with all the rest of us, all the rest of us sinners. You know, why would God let any of us go to heaven? You know, heaven is for the people that he heals from their sins, the repentant sinners. And I would say that's very likely to include you as well. So maybe a little, you know, reminder for yourself about how humility is important, and not being, like Jesus said, so quick to see the speck in our brother's eye, but yet you ignore the log in your own eye. Now, I don't know to what extent you have a log in your eye. It's not my place to know. But we should take to heart that emphasis on humility and ask the Lord, well, Lord, I'm a sinner too, so please help me to be better and to be saved. And I pray for all those other sinners out there as well. Those are my thoughts, Sharon. I hope that's helpful to you in some way. Thank you. Let's go now to, let's go to Diana in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about euthanasia.
Okay.
I have had several dogs that I've loved very much, and at the end of their lives, when they were in tremendous pain and it was clear that there was not going to be any relief right. from that, and that they were just dying, I took them to the vet and held them, you know, each one in their turn,
right.
Held them in my arms and just stayed with them and loved them. And then they were given the lethal injection mm-hmm. in my arms and basically left this world in a wave of love, even though I had tears streaming down my face. And, you know, I feel good about having given them a beautiful death.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be wrong to do for a person who was terminally ill.
Yeah, and that's a very emotionally powerful question that arises. So for the following reasons, Diana. Number one is that animals, as much as we may love them, and as much as we may enjoy their companionship, and those are all wonderful things, they're blessings from God, no doubt about it, but they don't have eternal souls. They have souls, they have a life principle, but when the animal dies, the soul that the animal had disappears. It's no longer present. So they don't go on to heaven. And I realize this opens a whole can of worms because it's a hot button issue for many people. But just suffice to say that animals, unlike human beings, they don't have rational, eternal souls. That's one reason. So we're dealing with a lower creature, and this leads to the second reason. We're dealing with a lower creature who doesn't have the capacity to understand the meaning of things, the meaning of pain, for example. Pain has no meaning to a dog who's dying, or a horse or something like that. So it is humane. It is proper, if it's within our power, to alleviate that suffering on the part of the animal by euthanizing it. It's not proper, however, to do that for a human being, because human beings have a dignity and the capacity not only to understand suffering, but also to make use of it. Now, it's not that I wish suffering on anybody. When I get a headache, I take an aspirin. So it's not like I'm the king of pain or anything like that. But we recognize that God gives human beings life. And at a certain point when our life is taken from us, in other words, it's time to go, that's something that God has the right to do, but we don't have the right to do that to each other. I don't have the right to take your life. I don't have the right to say, well, your life is not worth living because I think it's not worth living. So the church is really clear that unlike animals that we can euthanize, we can't do that with human beings. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice here. So those would be, maybe you might say, the preamble to a deeper question about this issue. But I'll stop there for a second. Does that help at least in get a sense of the differences we're dealing with?
I have a connected question. Who determined that animals don't have an eternal soul that's just at a lower level than ours, like ours is at a lower level than angels?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's who determines, ultimately, it's God who determines it. Now, how do we know that? It's revealed to us by God, for example, beginning in the garden with Adam and Eve. The animals were created and were told that Adam said, well, I want someone like me. I want somebody who's like I am. And God created Eve as the companion for Adam. So the story there shows us that animals are lower than human beings. They're not, I mean, they can be companions and helpers and workers and things like that, but they're not at our level. So I would say the starting point is that God himself has revealed this to us. But even in our own experience, we understand that animals, they have very rudimentary understanding of things. Some animals are quite smart, but they're not rational beings. They can't reflect upon themselves. They don't make plans in the sense that they think about, well, you know, a month from now, I think I should be doing this. They don't look back on things and evaluate them and think about them in a rational way. They don't have a will. They operate on the basis of instinct and appetite. Human beings, we also have instinct and appetite, but we also have a will whereby we can make decisions. So we can see, even just in our personal experience with animals and with ourselves, we can see that there's a vast distinction between them and us in that regard. Now, ultimately, of course, the church would look to somebody like St. Thomas Aquinas and other major figures who have also taught this same thing. And there's the music. So I'll leave it at that. If only there were more time. I'm sorry that you had to go through those painful situations, Diana, but I'm glad you called today. Thank you. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, back we are. Let's go to Mary in California. Hello, Mary.
Yes, I wanted to know why you can't spread the ashes after somebody dies, you know, around in the rivers and stuff like that. The biblical mm-hmm. reason, is it in the Bible for my Baptist friends?
Good question. We do see that in the Old Testament, the custom was to bury the person's body. We don't see any evidence of cremation, so that would be an implicit evidence from the Bible. If cremation were something that the Jews recognized as a good practice, we would have seen evidence of it, but we don't. So I think that right there it points us in the direction that they understood that interment was preferred over cremation. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yeah, but what about the spreading of the ashes? Is there a reason you can't spread them around? Mm-hmm. Isn't there something about the last day or something when Christ comes back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually plays into a misunderstanding that some people have, not that you do, but some people have thought that if you destroy the body in cremation and then scatter the ashes, then this Christian claim that at the end of the world everybody will receive their bodies back, that will somehow be impossible to take place. And scattering ashes or anything like that won't have any effect on that. God, being God, can make that happen. So there's nothing in the Bible that says that, but that would be an inference that we would draw from saying that God can do anything. So even if a body's ashes were scattered, it doesn't matter. It doesn't prevent God from reconstituting that body at the end of the world, if that's what you're driving at. Is that what you mean?
Okay, yeah, because she wanted to know why Catholics can't spread the ashes or keep them in their house and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I just wanted to some kind of answer for her.
Sure, yeah. So the reason that I, as a Catholic, would give is because the Church says not to. And the Church is my mother, and the Church has the authority to bind and loose, given to it by Christ, and this is something that she binds us to. So that's enough for me. But if we want to press further than that, we could say that the Church, in her wisdom, recognizes that by doing that, it's not showing the proper respect that should be shown to the temple of the Holy Spirit. So the body of a baptized person is the temple of the Holy Spirit, because at least at the time of baptism, God himself, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, indwelt that body. And so the Church says that the proper reverence for that person is to, you know, historically, the Church did not permit cremation. But now that it does, it still says that the remains of the person have to be in a dignified place. And part of the reason for that, too, is practical, so that family and friends and grieving members of that person's life can go and pay their respects at a certain place. But if the ashes have been scattered, you can't do that. So even just from a standpoint of human psychology, not that this is based upon human psychology, but we can look at it and say, you know, if your son or daughter were to die and the ashes were scattered, well, there's nowhere for you to go to spend time, you know, with that person, so to speak, or to pray for that person. And we as human beings need that, I think. And the Church recognizes that. So that's part of it, too.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Mary. Thank you. Let us go now to Bill in Lakewood, California. I'm sorry, Lakewood, Colorado. My mistake. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how do we recognize one another, especially our loved ones, in heaven when we die?
Hmm.
If they have no bodies, and
mm-hmm.
How do we recognize them?
Yeah.
As pure spirit.
Yeah. I think that keeping in mind that the spirit, that our soul is the form of our body, meaning it is the principle that animates and organizes and forms, you might say, our body, there's something there with regard to recognition. So we won't have, between the time we die and the time we receive our bodies back at the end of the world, we won't have eyes and ears and feet and hands, etc. So how will we see each other? How will we recognize each other? I think the answer lies in the way in which angels were permitted by God to appear to us, or figures in the Bible, for example, in a way that was intelligible. So what does that mean exactly? Well, we can look to the lives of the saints, and one who comes to my mind, Bill, is St. John Bosco, the famous Catholic priest in Italy in the middle of the 19th century, And he was favored by God with many visions and dreams in which he could see future events. And one of the things that he experienced, he talked about this in great detail, was after one of his proteges, one of his students, St. Dominic Savio, a young lad who died when he was 15 years old, God permitted him to have a vision of St. Dominic Savio in heaven. But he actually wasn't even in heaven. That story that St. John Bosco told was that he saw St. Dominic Savio and immediately recognized him, and they had a conversation, and he looked super enhanced, beautiful, compared to how he looked in this life. But it was him. I mean, it was him in, like, a, you might say, a glorified body. And he said to him, "Oh, this is amazing. This is what heaven is like. Oh, it's amazing. It's unbelievable." And St. Dominic Savio kind of laughed and said, "No, this isn't heaven. This is where I had to come in order to talk to you, because you can't get into heaven, because it would kill you. The intensity of seeing God face to face would kill you." And St. John Bosco said, "Can you show me even just a little glimpse of it?" So he said, "Okay, look over there on the horizon." And there was a little flash of light, as St. John Bosco said, from heaven, and it practically blinded him. It was so intense. My point here is that in these anecdotal examples, we have instances where the saints were permitted to see those who had passed on into the next life, and they recognized them instantly. So my thinking is that means that this is, by God's permission, a way in which the soul appears in the form and with the features and likenesses that the soul had in the life before, the life in this life. Does that make sense, Bill?
Yes. I was thinking when at the Annunciation, God sent Gabriel, and he assumed a human form so that she could see him.
We presume so. We're not told that, but we can easily presume that, I think safely.
But then, you know, we see one another with our eyes here on earth. Mm-hmm. When we become pure spirits in heaven, how do we recognize one another? Since, I don't know, the characteristics of...
We won't use our corporeal sense organs. We will not use eyes to see each other, or to see God for that matter. We will not use our ears to hear anything. We won't have a mouth with which to speak and utter words. These are all operations that will be conducted by the soul. And we know that the soul has the power to do these things, but how exactly that will be in heaven, it hasn't been revealed to us. So my thinking is that it will be even better than it is now, even more powerful than it is now, and then again, even more so when we get our bodies back. I'm looking forward to, I'd like to wait a little while before I find out, but eventually I'm looking forward to finding out. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. Let's go now to Judy in Lincoln, Rhode Island. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. I had a question about a person suffering here on earth. Does that automatically reduce our suffering in purgatory?
It does.
Or do we have to offer it? It does.
Well, it does if you offer it up. In other words, if you ask the Lord to accept this suffering as part of your own purification, then it does. But people can waste suffering by suffering and never giving a thought about God or themselves. I would call that wasted suffering. But if you use it, if you ask God to use it to purify you, yes, it definitely will cut down on your time in purgatory.
Okay, so we do have to ask, and we have to accept it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or at least we willingly offer it up. I mean, if I were, let's put it this way. Let's say that I were really ill with some very painful malady. I could say, and I think it'd be heroic to say, Lord, I accept this completely because it's your will for me. I don't think I have that level of sanctity to have that. Mm-hmm. But what I could say is, Lord, please heal me. And in the meantime, I offer up my sufferings to you. I don't want this suffering. I'd like, please take it away from me. Please heal me. And that can still be meritorious if you offer it up.
All right, one other question. Can we use our suffering for someone else's purification?
Yes. So you can offer your sufferings for the sake of, let's say, the poor souls in purgatory, or even for somebody alive in this life. You know, maybe you have a wayward son, and you say, I want to perform this penance on behalf of my son. Lord, would you please bring him back around? You can apply it in either way.
Okay. All right. That's what I needed to know. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Judy. Thank you. And God bless you. Let's go quickly to Ivan or Yvonne. I don't know how you pronounce it, in Chicago.
Hi. Yeah. I had a question about just buying stuff. Uh-huh. You know, you hear all sorts of horror stories about how some of our stuff is produced. Like you hear about in China, how they're, you know, basically genociding the Muslims in the mm-hmm. West. And yeah. I heard, take this with a grain of salt, but I heard that a fifth of the world's cotton supply comes from there. So okay. when I buy, say, some shirts at the store that are made of cotton, you know, how do I weigh, like, do I need this or do I not? Is it a sin to buy yeah. certain things if
okay,
I know they're
question.
Pretty much stolen?
We have about 45 seconds, Ivan, so let me offer a thought. You're not committing a sin if you go into Walmart and buy a cheap cotton shirt and it's made in China. You're not participating in the evil that the Chinese communists perpetrate, except at a very remote level. My thought is, if you have an opportunity to buy something different and avoid giving your money to an operation like that, so much the better. But you're not committing a sin if you go into Walmart and buy a shirt. Call me back another time. We'll go deeper. Thank you. I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.